Chapter 10.
It's worth pointing out that Renata didn't just marry a gay drug addict. That would have been bad enough. But she married a gay drug addict whose life was about to go haywire in ways he hadn't previously thought possible. I had a couple of years that were normal enough, at least by my standards. I watched Watford lose the FA Cup final. I made another album called Ice on Fire. Gus Dudgeon produced it. The first time we'd worked together since the mid-70s. In Britain, the big hit was Nikita, a love song to a Russian who Bernie, whether by accident or out of mischief, had given a man's name. At Live Aid, I set up an area backstage with fake grass and a barbecue so other artists could drop by. Freddie Mercury arrived, still on a high from Queen's show-stealing performance, and offered a very Freddie-esque appraisal of the hat I'd chosen to perform in. "Darling, what the fuck were you wearing on your head? You look like the Queen Mother." I went to Wham's farewell concert at Wembley in the summer of 1986, where I marked George Michael's momentous decision to leave the frivolity of pop music behind and announce himself as a mature singer-songwriter by turning up in a Reliant Robin dressed as Ronald McDonald. George wanted to sing Candle in the Wind as a mark of his new seriousness, but on stage I struck up with a pub piano version of When I'm 64 instead. But later that year, things started to go seriously off-piste for me. It began when I noticed there was something wrong with my voice while on tour in America. It was very odd. I was playing Madison Square Garden and I could sing fine, but found I couldn't speak in anything louder than a whisper offstage. I decided the best course of action would be to rest my voice between shows and make a joke out of it. I got hold of a Harpo Marx wig and a raincoat and took to wearing it backstage, honking a horn instead of speaking. But my voice got worse when we got to Australia. Just as we arrived, my new album came out. It was called Leather Jackets, and it was about as close to an unmitigated disaster as anything I'd ever released. I'd always tried to be strict about not using drugs in the studio, but this time that rule went completely out the window. The coke had precisely the impact on my creative judgment you might expect. I stuck any old crap on Leather Jackets. The big single was meant to be Heartache All Over the World, a song so lightweight you could have lifted it up with your little finger. There were old outtakes, songs that weren't good enough for earlier albums, but that, after a couple of lines, I suddenly recognised as lost masterpieces the public needed to hear as a matter of urgency. There was a terrible song I co-wrote with Cher called Don't Trust That Woman, the lyrics of which were beyond belief. You can rear-end her, ooh, it'll send her. You could tell what I thought of that by the fact that I declined to put my own name to it, crediting the song to Cher and my old made-up studio character, Lady Chockice. Of course, if you hate a song so much that you won't actually admit you wrote it, it's generally speaking a good idea not to record and release it. But I was so wasted that any kind of logic was completely beyond me. It wasn't all bad. Hoop of Fire was pretty classy, especially compared to the company it was keeping, while a ballad called I Fall Apart was another example of Bernie's uncanny ability to put words in my mouth that so perfectly express my personal situation I might have written them myself. But there was no getting around the fact that overall Leather Jackets had four legs and a tail and barked if a postman came to the door. So I wanted the subsequent tour to be something special. An event so ambitious and spectacular it would obliterate the memory of the album that preceded it. I told Bob Mackie to go as crazy as he liked on the costume front, which is how I ended up on stage in Australia, variously wearing a giant pink Mohican wig with leopardskin sides, another wig based on the explosive hairstyle made famous by Tina Turner in the 80s, and an outfit that made me look like Mozart had joined a glam rock band. A white sequin suit teamed with an 18th century powdered wig, white makeup and a fake beauty spot. The Mozart outfit was intended as a wry comment on the second half of the show, during which I was performing with the Melbourne Symphony Orchestra. If anyone thought I was being pretentious, a rock star carrying on like a great classical composer, well, I had made the connection first. Going on tour with an orchestra and playing rock and roll was something that no one had ever tried before. It meant that, for the first time, I could perform the songs from my early albums live, exactly as they had been recorded, complete with Paul Buckmaster's beautiful arrangements. Gus Dudgeon flew out to oversee the sound. We mic'd up every instrument in the orchestra individually, which no one had ever done before either, and the effect was astonishing. When the strings came in on Madman Across the Water, it took the top of your head off. They made a hell of a sound. With the bass cellos and the double basses in full flight, I could feel the stage vibrating underneath me, which was just as well, as the star attraction was struggling to make any sound whatsoever. For a singer, it was the most bizarre, disconcerting sensation. Whenever I opened my mouth on stage, I had absolutely no idea what was going to happen. Sometimes I would sound fine. Other times I would rasp and croak and wheezily fail to hit the notes. For some reason, it particularly seemed to affect me when I spoke rather than sang. I'd try to introduce a song and literally nothing would come out at all. It was as if someone had answered certain critics' long-held prayers by discovering a way of switching me off. Something was clearly very wrong. For a while I kept faith in the old sore throat remedy that Leon Russell had given me backstage at the Troubadour in 1970, gargling with honey, cider vinegar and water as hot as I could stand. It made no difference whatsoever. Eventually, after a show in Sydney during which the loudest sounds I emitted came not during the songs but between them, when I was racked by coughing fits and spat up gunk in a variety of colours so lurid that Bob Mackie's costumes looked sober by comparison, sanity prevailed, and I agreed to see an ear, nose and throat specialist called Dr. John Tonkin. He examined my larynx and told me I had cysts on my vocal cords. He didn't know at this stage whether they were cancerous or benign. If they were cancerous, that was it. My larynx would have to be removed and I would never speak again, let alone sing. He wouldn't know for sure until he performed a biopsy. Then he looked at me and frowned. "You smoke dope, don't you?" he said. I completely froze. I'd only started smoking spliffs to take the edge off all the cocaine I was doing, but had quickly discovered I enjoyed them in their own right. It was a different kind of drug to coke and booze, which I thought made me more sociable, despite an ever-increasing mountain of evidence to suggest that they were making my behaviour about as antisocial as it was possible to get. But marijuana didn't make me want to go out and party or stay up for days on end. It just made me laugh and made music sound fantastic. I had a particular love for getting stoned and listening to Kraftwerk. Their music was so simple and repetitious and hypnotic. Of course, being me, I couldn't just occasionally smoke a spliff and enjoy listening to Trans Europe Express or The Man Machine. I immediately became as gung-ho for weed as I was for everything else. By the time of the Australian tour, one member of the crew was more or less specifically employed just to roll joints. He went everywhere we did, carrying a shoebox full of the things. When Dr. Tonkin questioned whether I smoked dope, I decided to skip over the finer details of the spliff roller on staff. A bit, I croaked. Dr. Tonkin rolled his eyes, firmly said, "I think you mean a lot," and told me to stop. It might well have directly caused the cysts, and even if it hadn't, it certainly wasn't helping. I never smoked another joint. I wasn't exactly the master of personal resolve when it came to drink and drugs at that point. I lost count of the times I told myself never again while in the grip of a terrible hangover, only to forget I'd ever said it when the hangover wore off. Sometimes I would stick to my decision for months, but sooner or later I always ended up going back. It turns out there's nothing like being absolutely terrified to help you quit something, and nothing like the word cancer to make you absolutely terrified. Dr. Tonkin also told me I should cancel the rest of the Australian tour, but I refused. There was still a week of shows in Sydney to go. For one thing, the cost of cancelling would have been astronomical. There were over 100 musicians involved. We were supposed to be making a film of the shows and recording them for a live album. But more importantly, if there was a chance I was never going to sing again, I at least wanted to put off the day I stopped as long as I could. I decided I would take the same stoic show-must-go-on attitude when I told the band and crew what had happened. Instead, I walked into the bar of the Siebel Townhouse, yes, there again,
croakily announced, "They think I've got throat cancer," and then burst into tears. I couldn't help it. I was so scared. Even if the operation was successful, even if the biopsy came back clear, I might still be done for, at least as a singer. Julie Andrews had come out of an operation to remove a cyst on her vocal cords with her voice completely destroyed. We finished the tour. Sick and terrified, I stormed out of the final gig at the Sydney Entertainment Centre, which was being broadcast live on TV, minutes before the show was about to start. I could hear the orchestra playing the overture as I hurried out of the venue. I passed Phil Collins, who was coming in. He was taking his seat at the last moment so as not to be bothered by fans. He looked quite startled to see the star attraction heading in the opposite direction.
"Oh, hello, Elton. Hang on, where are you going?"
"Home," I shouted, not stopping. I had a bit of a history of storming out of venues when I was meant to be on stage. A few years previously, I had walked out of a Christmas show at the Hammersmith Odeon in a fury in between the end of the set and the encore. My car got as far as the Hogarth roundabout before I calmed down and decided to return. It's about 10 minutes away from the venue, but when we turned the car around, we realised the route back was going to take even longer because it involved going round a one-way system. Amazingly, the audience was still there when I got back. This time, I didn't even make it to the car before I had a change of heart. It turned out to be the best show of all. The thought that I might never sing again carried me through it. The highlight was Don't Let the Sun Go Down on Me. My voice was rough and raspy, but I don't think I've ever performed that song better. It was always pretty show-stopping with the orchestra thundering away, but that night every line seemed to have a new meaning, a different emphasis. After the tour, I went into hospital in Australia and had the operation. It couldn't have gone better. There was no cancer. The cysts were removed. After I recovered, I realised that it had changed my voice for good. But I liked how it sounded. It was deeper. And I couldn't sing falsetto anymore, but there was something about the sound I liked. It felt more powerful, more mature. It had a different kind of strength. I couldn't believe my luck. I thought 1987 had got off to a bad start, but now the only way was up. I couldn't have been more wrong. The first headline appeared in The Sun in February 1987. Elton in Vice Boys Scandal. But in retrospect, it was only a matter of time until The Sun came after me. I was gay, I was successful, I was opinionated, which in The Sun's eyes made me fair game for a vendetta. Its editor at the time was called Kelvin McKenzie, a man so toxic the Environment Agency should have cordoned him off. Under his control, The Sun wasn't really a newspaper so much as a spirited daily attempt to see how much racism, misogyny, xenophobia and especially homophobia could be crammed into 64 tabloid pages. It's hard to get across to anyone who doesn't remember The Sun in the 80s just how nasty it was. It treated people like shit, whether they were famous or not. It found a loophole in the law that enabled it to identify rape victims if no one had been arrested for the crime. It offered homosexuals money to leave Britain. Fly away, gays, and we will pay. When a TV actor called Jeremy Brett was dying of heart disease, The Sun sent journalists along to confront him in hospital and ask him if he had AIDS, a disease it also told its readers they couldn't contract through straight sex. I read the story about me with my mouth hanging open. The irony was there were dozens of men all around the world who could theoretically have sold a sex and drugs expose on me, ex-boyfriends, disgruntled one-night stands. On the evidence of their first expose, however, The Sun had managed to unearth someone I'd never actually met, who'd sold them a story about an orgy somewhere I hadn't been, the home of Rod Stewart's manager, Billy Gaff. In fairness, though, had they found someone who had actually slept with me, they couldn't have got a story like this. It wasn't so much that it was completely fabricated, although it was. It was that it seemed to have been completely fabricated by a raving lunatic.
I had allegedly readied myself for the orgy by donning a pair of skimpy leather shorts. Leather shorts. I've worn some ridiculous old tat in my time, but I've never, ever prepared for a night of passion by squeezing into a pair of leather shorts. You know, I'm trying to get someone to sleep with me, not take one look and run in the opposite direction screaming. Furthermore, I was apparently twirling a sexade between my fingers and looking like Cleopatra. Ah, of course, Cleopatra, last ruler of the Ptolemaic dynasty, lover of Julius Caesar and Mark Antony, and history's most celebrated dildo twirler and wearer of leather shorts. On one level, it was laughable, but on another, it wasn't funny at all. It was implying that the rent boys involved had been underage. If you repeat a lie often enough, people think it's true, especially if it's in print. What if people actually believed this? What the hell was I supposed to do? My mum and Durf were going to read this, maybe my grandmother. Oh, God, Auntie Wynne. She had a job in a newsagent. I could imagine her taking delivery of that morning's Sun, horrified, selling copies of it to people who knew who her nephew was and were laughing at her. My initial reaction was just to lock myself away in Woodside and hit the vodka martinis. Then I got a call from Mick Jagger. He'd seen the story and wanted to offer some advice. He told me I shouldn't, under any circumstances, try and sue them. When he'd issued a writ against the News of the World after they'd falsely claimed he'd bragged to an undercover reporter about his drug use in the 60s, they had reacted by spying on him and then setting up the famous drug bust at Redlands. He and Keith Richards had ended up in prison before a public outcry caused their sentences to be overturned. Weirdly, the conversation had the opposite effect to the one Mick intended. As I pointed out to Mick, I didn't really care what the press said about me. I'd occasionally get upset about a bad review or a hurtful remark, but that's the way it goes if you put yourself in the public eye. You just have to suck it up and get over it. But why should I let them get away with telling lies about me? I could prove that what they were saying wasn't true. On the date I was supposed to have been at Billy Gaff's house, dressed up like an extra in a Village People video and waving a dildo around like a majorette, I had been in New York having lunch with Tony King and discussing the finer points of my Tina Turner wig with Bob Mackie. There were hotel bills, restaurant receipts and plane tickets to prove it. I had the money to take them to court. Fuck them. I was going to sue. After I issued the first writ, the Sun published more and more stories filled with more and more lies. Every time one appeared, I issued another libel writ against them. Some of the lies were really unpleasant. They claimed I'd paid rent boys to let me urinate on them. And others were just bizarre. There was a claim I kept Rottweiler dogs with their voice boxes cut out. Elton's silent assassins. The only problem with this story was that I didn't own any Rottweiler dogs. Only two German shepherds, both of whom nearly deafened the RSPCA when they came down to check on their welfare. The Sun kept going even when it became apparent that the public didn't want to know. What they were doing clearly wasn't affecting my popularity at all. The stories were reported all around the world, but the live album we'd recorded on the Australian tour was a huge hit. Platinum in America, and the version of Candle in the Wind released from it as a single unexpectedly went top 10 on both sides of the Atlantic. What they were affecting was the Sun itself. Every time they put a story out about me on the front of the paper, the newspaper's sales dipped. I don't know whether people realised it was all untrue, or whether they saw it as a vendetta against me and thought it was unfair, or whether they were just bored stiff of hearing about it. Knowing they were in trouble, the Sun became increasingly frantic in their attempts to get something on me, anything that would actually stick. I was followed everywhere I went. When I stayed at the Century Plaza in Los Angeles, the penthouse suite was bugged. We had been warned by our solicitors that it might be. It was the suite where President Reagan always stayed, so we had the room swept by the FBI. Someone was trying to frighten me, trying to make me call the lawyers off. They offered to pay any rent boy £500 to say he'd slept with me. Not surprisingly, they were inundated with candidates, but they were all so obviously making it up that even the Sun balked at using them.
The best they could manage was to get hold of some Polaroids that had been stolen from my house. They were about 10 years old. One of them featured me giving a guy a blowjob. They printed them in the paper, which was mortifying. I tried to console myself with the thought that I could at least claim it as another first in my career. First artist in history to debut at the top of the US charts with 2 consecutive albums. First artist in history to have 7 American number ones in a row. First artist in history to appear in a national newspaper giving someone a blowjob. Besides, it seemed like a sign of desperation on the part of the Sun. Gay man sucks penis. It's not exactly a Pulitzer-winning scoop. In addition, it was written up in a way that I couldn't help but think told you more about the journalist than about me. It was all disgusting this and private perversion that. How boring does your sex life have to be for a blowjob to count as the height of unimaginable depravity? It went on and on for months and months until I'd issued 17 libel writs against them. I'd love to tell you that I never wavered in my conviction that I would defeat them, but it wasn't like that. Some days I would be fine, righteously angry, ready to take them on. Other days I would be in tears, totally despairing, even ashamed. I hadn't done any of the things they'd said I'd done, but I knew I'd laid myself open to something like this happening. My drug use was an open secret. I certainly hadn't slept with anyone underage, but then nor had I always been hugely discriminating in my choice of partners. A few years before, someone I slept with had helped themselves to a sapphire and diamond ring, a watch and some cash before they left. I worried about the court case, about having my private life dissected in public, about what the Sun would do to try and smear me. The thought of it made me do what I'd always done when things got too much. I would shut myself away in my room, just like I had as a kid when my parents were fighting, and try and ignore what was happening. The only difference was that now I would shut myself away with an abundant supply of booze and drugs. I wouldn't eat for 3 days, then I'd wake up starving and stuff myself with food. I would panic about gaining weight and make myself sick by jumping up and down until I puked. I had developed bulimia, although at the time I didn't know what bulimia was. What I did know was that certain foods were easier to throw up straight away than others. Anything stodgy, like bread, was difficult. You ended up bent over the toilet, retching and retching. I realised that you had to stick to things that were soft, so my diet became bizarre. When I was binging, my idea of a meal became 2 jars of Sainsbury's cockles and a pint of Haagen-Dazs peanut butter ice cream. I'd shovel it in, then bring it up again, sneaking off to make myself sick, thinking that no one would notice. Obviously they did. You come back smelling of puke, looking as if you've been crying because throwing up makes your eyes water. But of course, no one would dare confront me about it for fear of the consequences. Everything about it, from what I ate to how I behaved, seems completely disgusting now. But back then it became second nature to me. It was just how I was. Still, when things got really bad, I would eventually pull myself out of it, consoling myself with 2 thoughts. One was that, as far as the Sun went, I was absolutely in the right. If a single word of what they said was true, then I would never have dared sue them. And the other was that, however bleak things seemed, I knew of people far, far worse off than me, people who'd found the strength to deal with problems that made mine look completely insignificant. I'd first read a Newsweek magazine feature about an American teenager called Ryan White in a doctor's waiting room a couple of years before. I was simultaneously horrified and inspired by his story. It was a hemophiliac from Indiana who had contracted AIDS through a blood transfusion. And AIDS was a disease that had been playing on my mind a great deal. John Reed's PA, Neil Carter, was the first person I knew who died of it. He was diagnosed. Then 3 weeks later, he was dead. After that, the floodgates just seemed to open. Whenever I spoke to Tony King in America, where the epidemic was more advanced, he'd tell me of an old friend, or a friend of a friend who was sick. John Reed's secretary, Julie Leggett, was the first woman in Britain to be diagnosed with AIDS. My ex-boyfriend, Tim Lowe, had tested positive. So had another ex, Vance Buck, a sweet blonde boy from Virginia who loved Iggy Pop and whose photo was on the inside cover of my album Jump Up, just below the lyrics to Blue Eyes, the song Gary Osborne and I had written with him in mind. It was horrible. But ask any gay man who lived through the 70s and 80s and they'll tell you a similar story. Everyone lost someone.
everyone can remember the climate of fear. But it wasn't just the fact that Ryan White had AIDS. It was what had happened as a result of him contracting the disease. He had been ostracised in his hometown of Kokomo. The superintendent of his school district refused to let him attend classes in case he infected his schoolmates. He and his mother, Jean, became involved in a protracted legal battle. When the Indiana Department of Education ruled in his favour, a group of parents filed an injunction to block his return. They were allowed to hold an auction in the school gymnasium to raise funds to keep him out. When that failed, they set up an alternative school so that their children didn't have to go near him. He was abused in the street. His school locker was spray-painted with the word fag and his possessions were vandalised. The tyres on his mother's car were slashed and a bullet was shot through his family's front window. When the local paper supported him, they received death threats. Even their Methodist church turned its back on them. When it came to the blessing at their Easter service, no one in the congregation would shake Ryan's hand and say, "Peace be with you," to him. Throughout it all, Ryan and his mother, Jean, behaved with unbelievable dignity, bravery, and compassion. Christians who truly held to the teachings of Christ, they forgave the people who made their already difficult lives even more hellish. They never condemned, they just tried to educate. Ryan became an intelligent, sympathetic, articulate spokesman for people with AIDS at a time when AIDS was still being demonised as God's vengeance on gays and drug addicts. When I found out that he liked my music and wanted to meet me, I got in touch with his mother and invited them to a gig in Oakland, then took them to Disneyland the next day. I really adored them. Jean reminded me of the women in my family, especially my nan. She was working class, straight-talking, hard-working, kind, but clearly built with an unbreakable core of steel. And Ryan seemed absolutely remarkable. He was so ill that I had to push him around Disneyland in a wheelchair, but he wasn't angry. He wasn't bitter. He never cracked. He didn't want pity or sympathy. Talking to him, I got the feeling that because he knew he didn't have much time left to live, he didn't want to waste it feeling sorry for himself or angry at others. Life literally was too short. He was just a lovely kid trying to lead as normal a life as possible. They were an incredible family. We kept in touch afterwards. I would call, send flowers, ask if there was anything I could do to help. Whenever I could see Ryan, I saw him. When they couldn't stand it in Kokomo anymore, I loaned Jean the money to move her family to Cicero, a small town outside Indianapolis. I tried to just give her the money, but she insisted on it being a loan. She even wrote out a contract and made me sign it. Every time I felt hopeless about the situation I was in, I thought about them. That was real courage in the face of something truly appalling. So stop the self-pity. Just get on with it. Nevertheless, I kept a low public profile until Michael Parkinson got involved. I'd been on his chat show in the 70s. I'd ended up playing a pub piano while Michael Caine sang Maybe It's Because I'm a Londoner, and we'd subsequently become friends. He contacted me when The Sun Stories first appeared and told me he had a new chat show on ITV called One to One. Each episode was devoted to a single guest. Why didn't I come up to Leeds and appear on it? I said I wasn't sure, but he was persistent. I'm not doing this for me, he said. I'm doing this for you. I know you. I know what the Sun are like. You're not saying anything publicly, and you need to. If you don't say anything, people will assume you've got something to hide. So I eventually did the show. If you look at the clips of it on YouTube, you can see the effect that events were having on me. I was unshaven, dressed down, I looked haggard and pale. But it went well. The audience were clearly on my side. Michael asked about The Sun, and I told him that I'd just discovered they had tried to bribe the receptionist at my doctor's to hand over my medical records. I think they want to examine my sperm, I said, which is odd, because if you believe the stories they've been printing, they must have already seen bucket loads of it. Not long afterwards, the rent boy who had made the initial allegations in The Sun told another tabloid that he had made them all up and that he'd never met me. Don't even like his music, he added.
The morning the first libel case was due to come to court, the Sun completely caved in. They offered to settle for £1 million. It was the biggest libel payout in British history, although it was a good deal for them. If it had gone to court, they would have ended up paying me millions. That night, rather than prepare to take my turn in the witness box, I went to see Barry Humphreys at the Theatre Royal Drury Lane and laughed myself stupid at Dame Edna Everidge. Afterwards, we waited around in the West End to see the first edition of the next morning's paper arrive at the newsstands. When forced to apologise for making things up, the Sun was notorious for printing the correction as small as possible and burying it on page 28. But I said their apology had to be the same size as the initial allegations. A banner headline. Front page. Sorry, Elton. People subsequently said it was a landmark victory that changed British newspapers, but I'm not so sure that it changed the Sun very much. 2 years later, they printed the most notorious load of lies in their history about the behaviour of Liverpool fans during the Hillsborough disaster. So it's not as if checking their facts suddenly became a huge priority. What did change was the way newspapers behaved around me, because they realised I would sue them if they made things up. I did it again a few years later when the Daily Mirror claimed I'd been seen at a Hollywood party telling people I'd found a wonderful new diet, then chewing food and spitting it out instead of swallowing it. Elton's diet of death. I hadn't even been in America at the time. I got £850,000 and gave it to charity. The money wasn't the point. The point was to make something very clear. You can say whatever you like about me. You can say I'm a talentless, bald old puff, if that's your opinion. I might think you're an asshole for saying it, but if it was against the law to express colourful opinions about people, I'd have been locked up years ago. But you can't tell lies about me, or I'll see you in court. Renata and I divorced in early 1988. We had been married for 4 years. It was the right thing to do, but it was a horrible feeling. I'd broken the heart of someone I loved and who loved me unconditionally. Someone I couldn't fault in any way. She could have taken me to the cleaners, and I wouldn't have blamed her. Everything that had gone wrong was down to me and me alone. But Renata was too dignified and too decent for that. Despite all the pain, there was no acrimony involved at all. For years afterwards, whenever something happened to me, the press would turn up on her doorstep looking for her to dish the dirt, and she never, ever has. She just told them to leave her alone. I saw her once after we divorced. She had moved out of Woodside to a beautiful cottage in a small village. For all that had happened, there was still a very real love there. When I had children, I invited her to Woodside because I wanted her to meet them. I wanted to see her. I wanted her to be part of our lives and as part of hers in some way. But she didn't want to. And I didn't push the issue. I have to respect how she feels.